It's time for us to begin. It's certainly good to see all of you this evening, and I know that you're interested in the study of this period of the Kings, a fascinating period of time, I believe, in Old Testament history, as it's during this period that God fulfills the very promises that He has made unto the nation of Israel. Many of them, we've noted that God had promised unto Abraham that He would make of him a great nation, and that He would give unto him. We learn from Genesis chapter 15 that it would be four generations from the time of Abraham, but He would give unto him a certain land, and He defined very specifically the borders of that land. And at the time God made such promise, Abraham didn't have any children. Now we've seen that play out and develop with the great multitude that descended from Abraham while they were in Egypt. And we have seen how that they came up out of the land of Egypt and came into the promised land under the leadership of Joshua. And we saw how that Moses told them during the time that he brought them up that when you come into the land, if you worship and serve idols, God is going to destroy you out of this land. And we see that he also told them that the time will come when you will ask for a king. And when you ask for a king, here's the kind of king that needs to be appointed. And here are certain restrictions and requirements that God places upon the kings. Now, we saw that develop in 1 Samuel chapter 8 as they asked for a king. And we saw that play out. And we saw that Saul was their first king. He did bad things. Eventually, his attitude was one of arrogance. And we see that God rejected him and rejected him from being king. And then we saw that David was king. David messed up when he took the wife of Uriah the Hittite and committed adultery with her. And then we saw that his son Solomon became king. Now during the time of King David, God made a promise through Nathan the prophet that He would establish the throne of His kingdom forever. Now these are passages that you have in your list to remember, right? 2 Samuel chapter 7 is where we read about that. And we see that in the establishment of the lineage of David as kings, we see then his son Solomon becoming king, and then his son Rehoboam becoming king. But we note that the kings didn't always do what was right. Solomon married multiple wives contrary to the law of God from Deuteronomy chapter 17. He told them not to multiply wives. Solomon did. And we saw the reason God stated was indeed so in Solomon's case, as he was pulled away by these foreign women and began to worship idols. Rehoboam, his son, divided the kingdom, as you recall, over his poor judgment. That brings us up to 1 Kings chapter 12. And when the kingdom divided, who was it that was brought back or came back from Egypt and became the king of the northern 10 tribes? What was his name?
Jeroboam.
And he was a most wicked king. He introduced idolatrous worship among the people of God, calf worship. He set up a calf in Dan and one in Bethel. And we can read about that in 1 Kings chapter 13. Now, bringing us up to current, we've talked about the kings of Israel, bringing us up to King Ahab. And we've noted that Ahab was as wicked or more wicked than any of the kings before him. Now, one of the things that were the characteristics that we wanted to remember about the kings of Israel, the kings of Israel, the northern 10 tribes, not a good king in the whole lot, every one of them, worshipped and served idols. Now the threat of God was, if you worship and serve idols, I'm going to destroy you. Now we're going to see just how patient God was. King after king after king after king, and prophet after prophet after prophet, pleading with the people to return to God, and they wouldn't do that. And then we see that during the time of 722, the Assyrians became the empowered entity and conquered the northern 10 tribes and took Hoshea captive. And that was the end of the northern 10 tribes. And we're going to study some of that as we get a little further down the pipe. But now we want to talk about King Ahab, the wicked king, and the northern 10 tribes. Now the prophets during the time of King Ahab were Elijah, Elisha, and Micaiah. We want to remember that because that pigeonholes on the timeline that we're drawing in our minds. So when you think of Elijah, you'll think of Ahab and Jezebel. Now, as if Ahab wasn't wicked enough, he married old wicked Jezebel, and who was she? The daughter of the king of Sidon, and she worshipped Baal. And we know and discussed in the worship of Baal, it developed to the point that they were offering their children as sacrifices unto that idol. Now, this is the kind of thing that Ahab and Jezebel participated in and approved. Now, we want to note their character. But also we want to note in our study at this point, we've talked about the contest at Mount Carmel where Elijah challenges the people of Israel to decide who they believe is God. If Baal is God, serve him. If Jehovah is God, serve him. Now, you'll note that there was no fence straddling. There was no middle road. There was no third choice. It was one side or the other. And through that contest on Mount Carmel, they learned that Jehovah is God. And the prophets of Baal then were slain. And we saw how that old wicked Jezebel determined that she was going to kill or have killed Elijah the prophet. Elijah became very discouraged. And we read about that in 1 Kings chapter 19. And he even wished that he would die. He was so discouraged. And he went and hid in a cave a long way, long, long way from Samaria, where the capital city was. Now, we've discussed all that. I want to go on down now to chapter 20 of 1 Kings, and let's talk about Ben-Hadad. It's kind of as if there is just a parenthesis here in our timeline where we talk about the relationship of the nations that surround Israel, and this particular one, the nation of Syria. Syria was governed by King Ben-Hadad, and we saw that the region at that point in time had a different kind of government than what the Israelites were used to way back many years ago down in the land of Egypt. They were governed by city-states, and they band together against a common enemy, in this case under the leadership of Ben-Hadad. And Ben-Hadad determines that he's going to attack Israel. And his story is, I want you to give me all your silver and all your gold and anything that's valuable. I want it. And how did King Ahab respond to that demand? Sure, just come right up here and get it. And then Ben-Hadad said, I'm going to send messengers into your homes. And anything that you consider to be precious, I'm going to take it. And how did Ahab respond to that? When he consulted with the elders of Israel, no, can't do that. Can't do that. So we're going to have to oppose you on that. And so Ben-Hadad attacks anyway. And when he attacks, what happens to the army of Ben-Hadad? He's destroyed. Yes, he's sent packing back up to Syria. And this is about the middle of chapter 20. And we know that God said to Ahab, the king of Israel, I am going to deliver Ben-Hadad and his army into your hand. Now, God said that through a prophet to Ahab, wicked king, idolatrous king. God told Ahab, I'm going to deliver the king of Syria and all his cohorts into your hand. Why? So that you can know that I'm God. Well, did Ahab have a problem understanding who God is? He obviously did.
He shouldn't have, but he did.
Yeah. He shouldn't have, but he obviously did because he was one who worshipped Baal. instead of God. And we know then that in the text of the 20th chapter, upon the heels of this defeat, we find that Ben-Hadad escapes. And the people of Syria reason with Ben-Hadad that the reason we were not victorious at first is, you know, the God of the Israelites, He's the God of the hills. So what we need to do is match man for man, chariot for chariot, horse for horse, horseman for horseman. So what we had in that first battle, only we need to fight the battle in the plains down in Aphek. Now what happened down there?
It didn't fare any better.
Well, no, he didn't fare any better. And what was to be the lesson to Ahab? Well, Ahab was to learn, if you'll note there in verse 28, this man of God, the prophet, says to Ahab, I'm going to deliver Ben-Hadad into your hand. That you might know who I am. That's right. And you'll see that in verse 28. Well, when the Syrians came up against the children of Israel, it tells us that they slew 100,000 footmen in one day. So the Syrians face the Israelites, and the Israelites defeat them. But moreover, I think someone pointed this out earlier, that the wall of Aphek fell upon 27,000 men that were left, and Ben-Hadad fled and came into the city into an inner chamber. Now, what's left of Ben-Hadad's men, they want to know from Ahab, how can we settle this? Now, you see a whole different Ben-Hadad here. The Ben-Hadad that began the chapter was a man that was arrogant. I'm going to take all your stuff. And now we see, after these two major defeats, a year apart, what is Ben-Hadad requesting? That's right, mercy. Mercy. And you'll see that in verse 32 it is. It says, so they girded sackcloth on their loins and put ropes on their heads and came to the king of Israel. That would be Ahab. Came to the king of Israel and said, thy servant Ben-Hadad. We're in 1 Kings 20 for those of you that just came in. 1 Kings 20. Thy servant Ben-Hadad, verse 22, saith, I pray thee, let me live. And he said, is he yet alive? He is my brother. He's my brother. Who's your brother? Ahab is claiming that Ben-Hadad is his brother. So what's he willing to do? Accept him back. Show him mercy. What did God intend for Ben-Hadad to live? No. You see, Ahab was to understand who God is and God's judgment upon the Syrian king. In verse 33, it says, now the men observed diligently and hasted to catch whether it were his mind. And they said, thy brother, Ben-Hadad. Then he said, go ye, bring him. Then Ben-Hadad came forth to him and caused him to come up into the chariot. Now, the wording of this verse is somewhat interesting to me. As if the servants of Ben-Hadad can't believe their ears. Can't believe what I just heard. You're calling Ben-Hadad your brother? That's right. So you tell him to come on up. And so Ben-Hadad does come. And in verse 34, Ben-Hadad says unto Ahab, the cities which my father took from thy father I will restore, and thou shalt make streets for thee in Damascus, as my father made in Samaria. And I, said Ahab, will let thee go with this covenant. So he made a covenant with him and let him go. Was that a smart choice? No, he's had two opportunities to kill Ben-Hadad, and he's not killed him. And now he's made peace with him. Now I want you to look at verse 35 through the remainder of this chapter. Juan, would you mind to read for me verses 35 down through verse 38, please? chapter 20, verse 35 through 38.
Now a certain man of the sons of the prophets said to his neighbor by the word of the Lord, "Strike me, please, in the manner people strike him." Then he said to him, "Because you have not obeyed the voice of the Lord, surely as soon as you depart from me, a lion shall kill you." And as soon as he left him, a lion found him and killed him. And he found another man and said, "Strike me, please." So the man struck him, inflicting a wound. Then the prophet departed and waited for the king by the road and disguised himself with a bandage over his eyes.
All right, I want you to look at that carefully. Here's the man of God, a prophet, who has asked someone to hit him. Well, he wouldn't do it. There were consequences. He'd be killed by a lion. Finds another man, says, "Hit me." And he obliges him. He hits him, hurts him. And so the man of God bandages himself. Some translations say that he put ashes upon himself and waits for the king to come by. Now picture the scene. The king comes by and here's the prophet standing by the road and he's wounded. And he says then to the king as the king passed by, "Thy servants went out into the midst of the battle, and behold, a man turned aside and brought a man unto me and said, 'Keep this man. If by any means he be missing, then shall thy life be for his life, or else thou shalt pay a talent of silver.'" How responsible is the man who is charged to keep the enemy, the soldier? That's right. You keep him or I'll kill you. Now here's the lesson. In verse 40, "And as thy servant was busy here and there, he was gone. And the king of Israel said unto him, 'So shall thy judgment be, thyself hast decided it.' And he hasted and took the headband away from his eyes. And the king of Israel discerned him that he was of the prophets." Now here's the lesson, verse 42. "And he said, 'Thus saith Jehovah, because thou hast let out of thy hand the man whom I devoted to destruction, therefore thy life shall go for his life, and thy people for his people.' And the king of Israel went to his house heavy and displeased and came to Samaria." So many lessons in that. One is we see how God communicates often through a story. We saw how that Nathan told David a story about a man who had a little lamb, was like a daughter to him, and caused David to see the error of his way. And now we see through this prophet telling Ahab a story. The interpretation of the story is, your life's going to be required because you didn't kill Ben-Hadad like I told you to. Now, as we look at that, I want us to see this statement in verse 40. It says, "As thy servant was busy here and there, he was gone." The man charged to keep the soldier's security, or else it's going to cost you your life. Would you think that you would have some convictions about that? How about a little bit of devotion? How about a little bit of commitment to watch this man? You going to set him over there on a rock and go over here about your own business? Just think that here's the enemy and he's just going to sit there. Now isn't that foolish? You're charged to keep him with your life. And you're not going to give that your fullest attention?
The Philippian jailer had that same charge. And when something that he didn't even do occurred, he understood what was going to be required of him, even though he didn't have any, it wasn't his fault.
That's right. He drew his sword and expected to be killed.
Yeah.
Going to kill himself. Yes. Now, my life or yours? Now that's the charge that the prophet is telling Ahab. You've got a responsibility here. And it requires your attention. But while you're busy doing this or that, you see the enemy has his way. Now, again, there's so many lessons. There's a sermon in that somewhere, John, if you want to dig that out.
the things that we can busy ourselves with. We can talk about the difference between Martha and Mary. And note that Mary has chosen the good part, but Martha was cumbered about with much care. Now, this doing this or that doesn't mean that we're doing things that are sinful. In Luke, the 14th chapter, we can read of a fellow who bought a piece of ground, and a fellow who bought 5 yoke of oxen, and a man who took a wife, and couldn't come to the marriage, or to the feast, rather, that was provided, because they were distracted with other things. Now, I want to suggest to you, friends and brethren, that sometimes the things that distract us may cost us our soul, because we're busy doing this or that. And these distractions take us away from the things that ought to require our utmost attention. Now, who's going to answer for that? Who answered when Ahab neglected his duty? Ahab did. Yes. And he paid for it with his life. And we're going to see that in just a little bit. Now, we need to take note of that. And by the way, on another note, it's always interesting to me, though not necessary, but interesting to me when secular history records biblical events. So we know that these are not made up stories that somebody just wrote down and as a myth in the Bible. Secular history tells us of a battle that took place with Ahab and Ben-Hadad. So we know that there was a king of Israel named Ahab. And we know that he had a battle with the king of Syria. I didn't say that right. King Ahab and the king of Syria, Ben-Hadad. Maybe I did say that right. But we can see that in secular history. And know that such a battle occurred. Reference to it. Now, as we think further along those lines, I want to pass beyond some of these because I've already talked about that and have it. We've already discussed that. But I want you to see where Syria is in relation to Israel. Now, the first battle that Ben-Hadad engaged was in Samaria, and then Aphek, you see, down here in the plains area of Israel. Both battles went sour for Ben-Hadad. According to secular history, we learn that the battle between Ben-Hadad and Ahab, king of Israel, took place somewhere along the Orontes River, and you'll see that it runs quite some distance here, as it's referred to in history. Now, I want to talk more, if you will, about another event in Ahab's life. But before we do that, are there any questions as it pertains to this segment of his relationship with the king of Syria? We're going to revisit that as we look at the concluding remarks of that. But again, we've kind of got a parenthesis in the text of 1 Kings chapter 21 that we want to look at. All right?
There was one point in time where somebody, I was thinking it was somebody made an agreement with Ben-Hadad to say, hey, will you attack them? And I knew it was Israel that they were building that one, like, garrison into Judah's territory. They were building that one garrison, so Judah's king went to Ben-Hadad and said, hey, like, make a treaty with me so you'll attack the Israelites, and then they'll get away from that and I can do it. But so now Ben-Hadad saying, oh, we're brothers with Israel now, all of a sudden we got, so that's how it just goes.
Yeah, that's how it goes, back and forth. Yeah. Who's got the most money? Sound familiar? It's politics.
Well, as I mentioned in the class when we were talking about, I think it was Baasha, was the king that went and started building Ramah.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the thing is that all of those kings at that time, their armies were all mercenary armies. They sold themselves to whoever had the most money, mm-hmm. or whomever benefited them most at that particular time. There was no actual benefit to Ben-Hadad running way over to Israel to capture cities and things. He didn't have the wherewithal to keep that property very long. So, you know, it's just, well, you know, who's paying me today?
Yeah, politics. Who has the most money? That's exactly right. That's one of the things that makes this particular period of time fascinating to me, somewhat exciting, if I could use that term, because we see events transpiring then much like events transpire today among nations. But what we see then is we see God using these nations to maneuver things into position to fulfill the promises that He had made. We see His providence on every page.
Well, the ones that are going at us today are some of those exact same pieces of ground, too.
It is interesting, isn't it? It is indeed. Well, when we look into 1 Kings chapter 21, it tells us it came to pass after these things that Naboth, the Jezreelite, had a vineyard which was in Jezreel, hard by the place of Ahab of Samaria. Now maybe we ought to go back here and look at our map. The plains of Jezreel, right here. And this is where Naboth had a vineyard. Here's Samaria. So we're not talking about a great long distance away. And Ahab wants Naboth's vineyard. And look at the proposition that he makes to Naboth. Verse 2. And Ahab spake unto Naboth, saying, Give me thy vineyard, that I may have it for a garden of herbs, because it is near unto my house. And I will give thee for it a better vineyard than it, or if it seem good to thee, I will give thee the worth of it in money. And Naboth said to Ahab, Jehovah forbid it me that I should give the inheritance of my fathers unto thee. And Ahab came into his house, heavy and displeased because of the word of Naboth the Jezreelite had spoken to him. For he had said, I will not give thee the inheritance of my fathers. And he laid him down upon his bed and turned away his face and would eat no bread. Several things. Number one, we've got the king telling Naboth, give me your vineyard. Now we might reason and say, well, you know, we're to subject ourselves to civil authority, and so consequently, Naboth would have been all right to give the king his vineyard. No, that won't work. The king says, I'll buy it from you, or I'll trade you something better. Naboth says, no, that won't work. Now let's examine the reason why that won't work. Why couldn't Naboth just get it to him? Why couldn't he sell it or trade it to him?
It was his inheritance.
It was his inheritance. And what had God said about selling or giving away your inheritance?
Thou shalt not.
Now you can go back and just read that if you'd like in Leviticus chapter 25, verse 23, and Numbers chapter 36, there about verse 7. This is what God said. I find it interesting that Naboth, here we are way down the pike from the time of the giving of the law, but Naboth is not ignorant about what God said about this plot of land that was to belong to his family.
Yeah, God went so far as to bring up sort of unusual situations regarding this. He said, if a man have daughters only, and then he died, the inheritance will go to the daughters, but those daughters may not marry outside their tribe, so that their inheritance won't go into the hands of another tribe. So even amongst themselves, they could not exchange the possessions that were given them by God to another tribe within Israel itself.
All right, that's right. So God was very specific about what Naboth was and was not to do with his vineyard. And so what Naboth is doing is what God wants him to do. But Jezebel, well, another point, point number two, before I talk about Jezebel, is the response of Ahab. It tells us that he was heavy in his heart. He went to his room and he laid on his bed and turned his face to the wall and wouldn't eat. We might call that what?
Pouting.
That's what he's doing. That's exactly what he's doing.
I have a point to make on that and then a question.
All right.
So I think it's interesting that in verse 4, Ahab went into his house
sullen and displeased, is what the New King James said. That is exactly the same way that he left the prophet after the prophet told him, this is what you did with Ben-Hadad, and your life is going to be given in exchange for his. He pouted all the way home based on just the reaction. So that seems to be his go-to thing.
Yeah. Interesting observation. Verse 43 of the previous chapter.
Yes.
Yeah.
The other thing is, I'm wondering whether Ahab and Jezebel might have a secondary palace in Jezreel. Because there's, I know it's not a lot of distance, but there is some distance between Samaria and Jezreel. And Naboth the Jezreelite's vineyard is right up against Ahab's house. There are cities between Samaria and Jezreel. And then when you get further into the story of Ahab and of Jezebel, when Jezebel is flying down 70 times 7, it's at the gates of Jezreel, out of her house, at the gates of Jezreel. And it seems like she would have to have a house in Jezreel in order for that to happen.
That's a very interesting observation. I've not thought of that. It's good. That very well could be.
It's not uncommon for the kings of those days to have several places.
Well, that's right. And if we look at our history, it's not all that uncommon for those who are in positions of power or wealth to have several homes. So I would say that would be within the realm of possibility.
It's interesting to note that the town of Jezreel is not even mentioned until Ahab is coming down to the top of Mount Carmel. So there's no real history about this. It just all of a sudden he went to Jezreel. And you go, okay, why? We realized that there was a lot of activity going on there.
Yeah.
That one of his houses at least was there.
Yeah.
Jezreel was a place that was sought after because I remember when they divided the tribes up.
Yeah. That was the point I was going to make. I'm glad you said that. This is kind of a choke point. Jezreel, the plains of Jezreel, and Megiddo. We find that the trade routes went this way, so it was kind of a choke point, as well as very valuable property commercially. These plains were very much desirable.
Yeah, two of the trade routes went through there, and if you could hold that narrow choke point, like say, then you have control to get money out of it.
That's right. That's right. Okay. Any other comments or questions? That's good, Jenny. I'm not told.
About I was going to say also that I think as I look at the map, that Samaria is sort of a high place up in the hills, hill country, whereas Jezreel is down in the plain of Jezreel.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would consider that to be a more agricultural area,
yeah,
or something like that than,
yeah,
than Samaria, which was really, I guess, started off as a high place. High place of worship, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. You were talking about Samaria?
Did I say? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, these Syrians say that it's in the mountains. So, yes, it's a higher elevation, obviously. Yeah. Excellent. Good points. All right. This map don't help us on that particular point, so we'll go back to this one. In chapter 21, verse 5, to answer your inquiry, I don't know. But it sounds plausible that there would be a house there. I've just not thought about that. I'll have to study some more on that particular point. In verse 5, it says, and Jezebel, his wife, came to him and said to him, why is thy spirit so sad that thou eatest no bread? And he said unto her, because I spake unto Naboth the Jezreelite, and said unto him, give me thy vineyard for money, or else, if it please thee, I will give thee another vineyard for it. And he answered, I will not give thee my vineyard. Now, look at how Jezebel reasons. She said, dost thou now govern the kingdom of Israel? Now, she thinks that's a legitimate question. Well, you're the king. How dare he say no? He can't say no. You're the king. You can do what you want to. Not with immunity. No. You're going to suffer consequences. But Jezebel doesn't know that just yet. She said, arise and eat bread and let thy heart be merry. I will give thee the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite. Now, how does she propose
to do that. John?
Well, she writes letters to the nobles and the rulers of Naboth's land and says, if any peace here that they had towards this land, say he blasphemed in some way, then take on some.
Yep. Yep, take it off, stone. Yep, he in some way has blasphemed, and so you take him out and stone him. And so in verse 14, it tells us that they sent to Jezebel and said, Naboth is stoned and is dead. And it came to pass, verse 15, when Jezebel heard that Naboth was stoned and was dead, that Jezebel said to Ahab, arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give thee for money, for Naboth is not alive, but dead. And it came to pass, when Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, that Ahab rose up to go down to the vineyard of Naboth, the Jezreelite, to take possession of it. Yeah.
Well, you see that she did know the law because she went by devious. She didn't just go in and say, well, he's the king, you've got to give it to him. Because Ezekiel says, the prince can't come in and thrust you away from your inheritance. So she did know, so she went about it, you know, illegally to get it done.
Yeah, there was kind of a mock court, so to speak, through which Naboth was sentenced to death. And now go take your vineyard. Yeah, that tells us a lot about Ahab and Jezebel. This particular story of the vineyard. Well, we said you can't do that without consequences, and so there were indeed to be consequences. When you pick it up at verse 17, it says, the word of Jehovah came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, arise, go down to meet Ahab, king of Israel, who dwelleth in Samaria. Behold, he is in the vineyard of Naboth, whether he's gone down to take possession of it. And thou shalt speak unto him, saying, thus saith Jehovah, hast thou killed and also taken possession? And thou shalt speak unto him, saying, thus saith Jehovah, in the place where dogs lick the blood of Naboth shall dogs lick thy blood, even thine. And Ahab said to Elijah, hast thou found me, O mine enemy? And he answered, I have found thee. Because thou hast sold thyself to do that which is evil in the sight of Jehovah, behold, I will bring evil upon thee, and will utterly sweep thee away, and will cut off from Ahab every man child, and him that is shut up, and him that is left at large in Israel. And I will make thy house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah, for the provocation wherewith thou hast provoked me to anger, and hast made Israel to sin. And of Jezebel also spake Jehovah, saying, the dogs shall eat Jezebel by the rampart of Jezreel. Him that dieth of Ahab in the city of the dogs, in the city the dogs shall eat, and him that dieth in the field shall the birds of the heavens eat. But there was none like unto Ahab, who did sell himself to do that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah, whom Jezebel his wife stirred up. And he did very abominably in following idols, according to all that the Amorites did, whom Jehovah cast out before the children of Israel. Well, there's consequences going to come to Ahab. Now, we know that Ahab raises the question to Elijah, hast thou found me? Well, what a thing to ask the prophet of God. Sure, I found you. Think you're going to hide? And then the text tells us that Ahab had sold himself to do evil. Sold himself. You ever make a deal with the devil? You don't answer that. Well, Ahab has sold himself, as it were, to do the things that are evil. He's only interested in himself. It doesn't matter what God says.
I find it interesting that the verse 24 about that whoever dies in the city, the dogs will eat, and whoever dies in the field, the birds will eat. That is said basically word for word for Jeroboam, Baasha,
it is, isn't it? Evil, wicked men. Yeah. And woman. Yeah.
Okay? All right, well, let's notice these consequences. Dog's going to lick your blood. Chapter 21, verse 19. Came to pass. If you turn the page over to chapter 22, and begin reading at verse 37, we find in another segment of the life of Ahab, where Ahab and Jehoshaphat, lots to say about that, but they enter into an alliance to fight against whom? Syria again. That's right. Fight against Syria. And the prophets have told King Ahab, go right ahead, you'll be fine, all is well. And Jehoshaphat raises the question, isn't there another prophet that we can make inquiry of God and find out what's going on? And what did Ahab say?
Thank you. When I read that, would that be the prophets of Baal would be the one that said, yeah, you're going to be okay.
That's right.
And Jehoshaphat says, is there a prophet of God?
Is there somebody else? Yeah. Yeah. And he said, yeah, there's another prophet. His name is Micaiah, but I hate him. And why do I hate him? He never tells me anything good. Now, I find it fascinating, again, in the text, when you read down the prophets, the false prophets, who said, go ahead, everything's good, you'll be victorious. When the messenger came to Micaiah, he tells Micaiah that all these other prophets, here's what they've said, their words are all good. And so now you line up. You get in line and you tell the king that everything's going to be fine. And Micaiah says, as Jehovah liveth, what Jehovah saith unto me, that will I speak. And when he was come to the king said unto him, Micaiah, shall we go to Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall we forbear? And he said, go up and prosper. And Jehovah will deliver it into the hand of the king. Now what did Micaiah do?
Sarcasm.
I like that word. Sarcasm. That's right. This is what you want to hear. This is what the messengers told me to say. This is what all the other prophets said. Now, John, there's you another lesson. You can either line up with everybody and everything's good, or you could be like Micaiah and tell the truth and everybody hates you. Now, where did the Lord ever say that everybody's going to love you? In fact, Jesus said that they of your own house shall prove themselves to be your enemies. You can read that in Matthew chapter 10, reading beginning about verse 34. Now, that's just the way that that is. Now, somebody can come and tell you everything's good, but that's not going to make it so. Now, the irony of this is Ahab's words of all people. For Ahab to say to Micaiah in verse 16, how many times shall I adjure thee that thou speak unto me nothing but the truth in the name of Jehovah? That just bewilders me. Why in the world is Ahab not just high on delight at what Micaiah has said and just stop right there?
Well, I was going to just ask you just now if you had already leapt out of chapter 21 and were not to return.
But no.
Because in verse 27, after Ahab has received this admonition from the prophet, it says, when Ahab heard those words, he rent his clothes, put sackcloth on his flesh, and fasted and lay in sackcloth and went softly. And the word of Jehovah came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, seest thou how Ahab humbleth himself before me? Because he humbleth himself before me, I will not bring the evil in his days, but in his son's days will I bring the evil upon his house. It appears that Ahab has sort of kind of turned a little bit of a leaf. Not much of one, I would say. But
a little bit of a leaf,
yeah.
But not much of one. I got a chart on that. So we'll have to talk about that.
I got 5 more minutes, you do.
Hey, great.
4 minutes. Now.
4 minutes, okay. We'll talk about that more when we get over to 2 Kings chapter 9. But yes, Ahab does appear at this point to humble himself. And so now he's hearing words from Micaiah. When Micaiah tells him that, verse 17, I saw all Israel scattered upon the mountains as sheep that have no shepherd. And Jehovah said, these have no master. Let them return every man to his house in peace. The king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, did I not tell thee that he would not prophesy good concerning me but evil? And Micaiah said, therefore hear thou the word of Jehovah. I saw Jehovah sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing by him on his right hand and on his left. And Jehovah said, who shall entice Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one said on this manner, and another on that manner, and there came forth a spirit that stood before Jehovah and said, I will entice him. And Jehovah said unto him, wherewith? And he said, I will go forth and will be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And he saith, or said, thus shalt thou shalt entice him, and shalt prevail also, go forth and do so. Now therefore, behold, Jehovah put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these thy prophets, and Jehovah has spoken evil concerning thee. Now, this kind of gets us back, not as far as we want to go, but eventually we'll get there, to Ahab's supposed repentance. Ahab doesn't want to believe anything that God says. And when you don't love the truth, what has God assured us that you will do? You will believe a lie. And God said through the Apostle Paul, I will send a strong delusion that you may believe a lie and perish. Now Ahab, he doesn't want to hear what the prophet Micaiah has said. But he's very much interested in hearing what these false prophets have said. Now, if you hear something that is in error, and you practice or conduct your life accordingly, you might die with a smile on your face. Say, all is well. But all is not well. Believing a lie results in eternal destruction. You don't want that. But let me assure you this as well. Sometimes believing a lie, notice if you will, there are numerous prophets that have come to Ahab and told him a lie. Lying spirits, it says. Several of them. Once you have swallowed a lie, sometimes it's difficult to believe the truth. Case in point. When you go back a little bit in Israelite history, you remember during the time of Joseph. What was Joseph's father, Jacob, led to believe had happened to Joseph? That he was dead. That he was killed by a wild animal. Now, I made the mistake one time. I was teaching class on this, and I said, you see, the brothers of Joseph lied to Jacob and told him that their brother had been eaten up by the wild beast. That's not so. They did everything but tell him. That's right. Now, they didn't tell him that, but they did everything to provide evidence to lead him to that conclusion. Now, when he believed the lie, he would not be comforted. And 22 years passed before he found out that Joseph was still alive down there in Egypt. And how did Jacob respond to that information? Not so. My son's dead. He had believed a lie. And it took some powerful convincing, the wagons and the provisions that Joseph had sent, to convince him that Joseph was still alive. Now I want us to notice that. Ahab was happy believing a lie. But when he heard the truth, it didn't make him very happy at all. Okay, we'll stop with that.